Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and a very warm welcome to today's broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick and I'll be with you for the next half hour. In a few moments, I'll be bringing you an interview with the head of the Catholic Church in the Philippines, Cardinal Luis Tagle. As Pope Francis pays a visit to the Italian President, Giorgio Napolitano, Professor Gerald Fogarty sheds light on the Lateran Pacts. In a related story, I'll be introducing you to a Renaissance cardinal by the name of Oliviero Carafa. But first, I'd like to bring you a report focusing on the weekly Wednesday General Audience of Pope Francis with pilgrims from across the world, which took place, as almost always, in St. Peter's Square, a moment during which Pope Francis expressed great sorrow over the tragic loss of innocent lives in the conflict in Syria. Tracy McClure.
The Pope said he was deeply saddened by a mortar attack on a school bus in a Damascus suburb. At least 5 children and their bus driver were killed, and 4 other children were injured as they were returning home from school on Monday. Another mortar attack on a Damascus school the same day wounded 11 children. The Pope prayed for an end to such tragedies and said the attack occurred just as we are praying and uniting our forces to help our brothers and sisters struck by the typhoon in the Philippines. These are the true battles to fight, he said, for life, never for death.
Affermiamo la nostra vera identità di figli di Dio.
In his catechesis for Wednesday's audience, Pope Francis reflected on the sacraments which bring the grace of God's forgiveness, like baptism, which washes away original sin and personal sin. Pope Francis said the sacrament of confession can open the door to a new life as the merciful God enters our lives. Do your homework, he said. Find out when you were baptized.
È un compito, per fare.
And thank God for opening the door of his church on that day when you received baptism. Confession, if done often with humility and contrite heart, can be like a second baptism, the Pope said. And in this way, confession is not like a stint in a torture chamber, but rather a celebration of the day of baptism.
E così la confessione non è una seduta in una sala di tortura.
The Pope recalled our human frailties, asking, "We are all weak and we are all sinners, no?" But that doesn't mean we have less of a responsibility to ask forgiveness every time we make a mistake. I'm Tracy McClure.
And while my thanks there go to Tracy McClure, in an effort to find out more about the dramatic situation in the Philippines, I'd like you to listen to an interview Susie Hodges did this past week with the head of the Catholic Church in the Philippines, Cardinal Luis Tagle. He told her how speechless the images of the massive destruction caused by the typhoon left him. But at the same time, he also mentioned how consoling he found the love and solidarity that is pouring in from all over the world in the wake of this disaster.
I think I'm not alone in saying that every time we see images of the destruction, we are left speechless. We are still recovering from the emotional and psychological shock. If we here in Manila and in other parts that have not been affected as much as others, just seeing the images are already left in a way speechless. I can imagine what's going through in the minds and hearts of the others who were there. And we just draw strength from the love, the concern, the solidarity that are just pouring in, not only from different parts of the Philippines, but from all over the world. And I am deeply consoled when I see and hear testimonies of faith, especially from the victims themselves. Those who have lost loved ones, property, they turn to God and say, "In God we have hope. In God we know we can survive." I don't know how that could be said, except by the help of grace, by the presence of deep faith that enables people to hope.
You've presumably talked to members of the church who are in the more badly affected areas. What do they say about how the church is trying to help in this desperate race to get food and water to the survivors?
You know, some of the bishops in the most adversely affected areas, especially on the island of Leyte, you know, they have not even been able to contact us through telephones, through internet. And so communications in some areas are still down, the communication lines. But from the little reports that we are getting from some people in the areas, the local churches in those areas also suffered a lot of loss. And so much of the help being given by the church comes from outside of those dioceses. So right now, the Archdiocese of Manila and our neighboring dioceses, the Suffragan dioceses, with Episcopal Commission on Social Action, or Caritas Philippines, we are coordinating much of the effort to reach out to those people that are affected and are not still reached by their own pastors.
Given the scale of the devastation, do many people there fear that some people will die not just from the direct result of the typhoon, but from not getting badly needed food or water or medicine in this aftermath?
Yes, that is a real possibility. That's why church people, non-governmental organizations, and the government agencies, and even the military, all of us have been trying our best to reach whatever place, you know, and try to put a bit of system. It's not always easy, but everyone is trying to do his or her share because it's really an emergency. We can even say it's a panic time, you know, for many.
Is there a fear that with so much aid flooding in and so many aid workers flooding in, that there'll be a lack of coordination? This is often a problem, isn't it, in the wake of such vast disasters on the scale of this one?
Yes, I think this is an eye-opener to especially to the government agencies. I should say that they did their best in warning people and transporting them before the coming of the typhoon. But I think we were all shocked to realize that this typhoon is really massive. You know, we get 20 to 22 typhoons every year. So you can say that as a country, as a nation, we are used to having typhoons, especially the islands of Samar and Leyte. But the residents there were really shocked. For some of the elders, they say this is the first time they've experienced something like this. Some of them could not even believe that this is a typhoon. And so the warnings and the evacuation efforts, which were all done, somehow even failed to meet the onslaught of this super typhoon.
And finally, have you seen a massive outpouring of solidarity from lay Catholics, shall we say, in Manila and other areas which weren't really badly affected to try and help their brothers and sisters, their fellow Filipinos who are in such dire need now?
As I said, that's a source of great consolation and strength. Before this typhoon, we had an earthquake that affected the central part of the country, very close to Leyte and Samar. And our reflections now continue along that line. We see rubbles, we see ruins everywhere, but we see also faith, love arising from the ruins and making us stronger people. Want to thank everyone, the Holy Father, our brothers and sisters, even outside of the country, for remembering us and trying their best to reach out. In the name of the victims and the poor, we really thank you. Really thank you.
It must be indeed heartbreaking because it is such a huge disaster. You can be sure that we're thinking of you.
Thank you very much.
Many, many thanks there to Cardinal Luis Tagle and also to Susie Hodges for bringing us this interview. But getting back to Pope Francis, on Thursday, 14th of November, he went on his first official visit to the Italian President of the Republic, Giorgio Napolitano. The last such visit on the part of a Roman pontiff took place in June 2005, when Benedict XVI, now Pope Emeritus, drove up to the Quirinal Hill for the second time in his pontificate. By doing so, he was following in the footsteps of a string of predecessors to the See of Peter. For the record, the first pope to return to the Quirinal and cross the threshold of what was until 1870 a papal residence was Pius XII in 1939, when Italy was still a monarchy and the king was Victor Emmanuel III. In fact, the first pope to pay a courtesy visit to Italian authorities after the birth of the Italian Republic was John XXIII, who met with President Antonio Segni on May 11, 1963. The Quirinal Palace, where Pope Francis met with the Italian president, was begun in 1573 by Pope Gregory XIII for summer residence for the popes. That's before it became home to the kings of Italy, as I mentioned, in 1870, when the pope became a prisoner in the Vatican of his own will, retreating behind Vatican walls until the signing of the Lateran Pacts in 1929. Pope Francis actually mentioned these Lateran Pacts when he met with the president.
Vorrei ricordare l'inserimento nella Costituzione Repubblicana dei patti lateranensi e l'accordo.
But what exactly were they? That's what I asked Jesuit historian Father Gerald Fogarty, who's currently teaching at the University of Virginia in the United States. Let's listen to what he told me. To February 11th, 1929. We talk about the Roman question and the Lateran Pacts, but there are different parts to that. Lateran Treaty, a Concordat, and a Third Pact, aren't there?
Yeah, it gets complicated. They overlap. A Concordat, for our English-speaking listeners, is important. There's never been a Concordat in an English-speaking country because of the British and American common law. You have the rights that are not restricted by going to court. Whereas in the Roman law tradition, which runs throughout Europe for the most part, you have the rights the state gives you. So therefore, a concordat was an agreement between the Holy See and the government to guarantee the rights of the church within a particular country. And almost every European nation does have a concordat. So therefore, that was one of the things that came in. The treaty was to end the Roman question. There would be an indemnification for what was lost and so forth, the land lost. And the Pope had never touched what had been set aside in the Law of Guarantees in 1872. So now there was a general indemnification. And then included in that was the freedom of communication with his bishops everywhere and also the right to the diplomatic corps and the right of cardinals, who at that time were given the rank of Prince of the Blood, by the way. They were considered to be royalty and to be treated as such. But thank God we've done it with. Yeah.
So anyway, this definitively put an end to the Roman question.
Yes, and what it meant was, by 1861, all of Italy was now united except for the city of Rome. The city of Rome still remained in the temporal control of the Pope, only because French troops had come to defend the Pope here. So therefore, that's why the end of the control over Rome, that's why it becomes the Roman question. Because after all, the Pope is the Bishop of Rome, and yet he never visited his own cathedral. From 1870, St.
John Lateran.
That's right. People, St. Peter's is not a cathedral. It is a major basilica, but the chair is not there. The chair, that is the cathedral, is actually St. John Lateran. And that's where the Pope had...
That's why he's called Bishop of Rome, the Pope.
That's right. And one of his many titles. So that was the significance that now the Roman question was settled with the Holy See recognizing that the Kingdom of Italy in 1929 now had control of the city of Rome, legally. And it brought about a regularization between the two entities.
So it was a rigid and rainy day, and a Mussolini for the Italian state, and Cardinal Gasparri for the Holy See, then it was.
Holy See. And then right after that, Gasparri resigned, and the new Secretary of State was Eugenio Pacelli, who later on became Pius XII. And we could talk about this at some other time, perhaps, but that also brought about a change in the attitude of the Holy See towards the United States. The Holy See regarded the United States in 1899 with great suspicion. Gradually, that starts to change because it was obvious that another war was going to come. And with that other war, the Holy See knew they would have to do something with the United States.
And Pius XII was the first to visit the United States, but not as Pope.
That's right. In 1936, the first Pope to come as Pope was Paul VI. But Pacelli came over in 1936, supposedly as the house guest of Mrs. Brady, who endowed a number of things around here. And the trip was taken over by this auxiliary bishop who was a close friend of Pacelli's who had worked in the Secretary of State. His name was Francis Spellman. He was auxiliary bishop of Boston. And he and Mrs. Brady had a major falling out because Bishop Spellman knew that Pacelli wanted to meet the president, Roosevelt. So how do you arrange this? And finally, it was done in 1936 through this subterfuge. You had the official hierarchical group working on it through the United States State Department, when all of a sudden Pacelli called the apostolic delegate, the papal representative, to the hierarchy. He said, don't worry, we have made arrangements through Monsignor Spellman. It was done through Joe Kennedy, the father of President John Kennedy. And the idea was that they would meet at the president's mother's house for lunch 2 days after his election to a second term. So it was not an official state visit. Because how did you arrange for the prime minister and foreign minister of an entity with which the United States does not have diplomatic relations to meet with the head of state? So that was the problem.
Going back to the Lateran Pacts, of course, beyond that historic signing in 1929, there was a lot of behind-the-scenes work that went on towards that moment, long before that date, no?
Oh, yeah. In fact, the work for that began at the Treaty of Versailles in 1919. And there was this interesting priest,
American.
Francis Kelly. And he became the Bishop of Oklahoma City later on. But he had in his diary or something how he talked to the foreign minister. And a lot of people thought this was phony until the actual signing of the pact, where the foreign minister of Italy said the first step was taken by this American priest, who could sort of be incognito to a great extent. Incidentally, the Lateran treaties did not end hostility between the Holy See and the government. By that time, the fascist government was in control of the government under the king, under the House of Savoy. But by 1931, there was great tension. The Concordat had been violated. So then there was an encyclical condemning fascism.
Pius XI's 1939 encyclical, Non Abbiamo Bisogno, on Catholic Action.
They couldn't publish it in the city because the fascists had shut down the Catholic presses, so it had to be smuggled out of Italy. And they gave it to this then Monsignor Spellman, who was working in the Secretariat of State, because as an American citizen, they weren't going to stop him. And he took it by train to Paris, where it was published by the Associated Press and United Press International, the first encyclical I know of that was not published under official church auspices, but under, you know, the regular journalistic outlets.
And did it get a lot of publicity?
It did, because it was clear then that the Pope was not at all sympathetic with fascism. He was willing to cooperate with them. 2 years later, he signed the Concordat with the Third Reich, with Hitler. And at that time, he made the comment he would sign a concordat with the devil if it meant he could preserve the rights of the church. There's a book done by a German scholar recently they called The Pope and the Devil, because picking up on that phrase. But the purpose of any concordat is to preserve the rights of the church and give it standing, give any dispute standing within international law.
And wasn't he criticized for that?
Oh, yeah, well, especially his Secretary of State. But after all, still, it was the Pope who is the one who authorized the negotiation and the signing of the concordat. But he was criticized because was this recognition of Hitler. Well, it had been under work from 1929, actually, because before Pacelli became Secretary of State, 1914, he was appointed as the nuncio to the Kingdom of Bavaria. And then with the new empire, with the Weimar Republic after 1919, then he became the nuncio also to the Weimar Republic. He was there for another 10 years, 1929, when he came back here to Rome. I say back here to Rome because he was Roman-born.
Pius XI found it hard to actually adapt to the new situation after the signing of the Lateran Pacts. He couldn't be persuaded to move out of the Vatican, but there were some exceptions, like the time he did go to
Castel Gandolfo,
1938.
Yes.
And there was a reason connected
to very definitely a reason. Because Hitler was making a state visit to the city of Rome, and there was all this preparation, the Via Foro Imperiale. They just probably shoveled over all sorts of ruins to make this wide avenue. Everyone has seen it somewhere near the Colosseum into the
Piazza Venezia.
Yeah, and it's probably under it where a lot of ruins.
Probably destroyed a lot of beautiful things.
Yeah.
Buildings and architectural
marvels. What the Pope did is normally he doesn't go out to Castel Gandolfo until July, although maybe they start going out earlier now because...
Depends on the popes. The popes have had different patterns.
Time he went out in May so that he would not be present. And they also closed the Vatican museums. And then there was debate as to whether or not Hitler would ask for an audience. He didn't. And what would the Pope respond if he did? Then there was a marvelous naval parade because they had to do that in Naples. So they took the train down with Hitler, and the United States naval attaché went down, and they had 90 Italian submarines that all came out in one mass flotilla, and they dove on one end of the harbor, and several minutes later they all rose at the same time at the other end. And even our United States naval attaché was fascinated by this. For the display in the Piazza Venezia here, most of the ambassadors were not invited, and the United States was not invited, for instance. So the United States ambassador to the kingdom took a seat that he could get. He was getting to be elderly. And nevertheless, he described what happened because Mussolini was fascinated by the Nazi soldiers and their goose step. So he put in what they called the Passo Romano. It was goose-stepping Italian troops. Didn't quite work. And a lot of comments in the newspapers because what they were used to was the Passo Italiano, which was much more freewheeling. The Italians cheered when that happened, when they saw it. And by the way, the Pope also had an audience for several hundred newly married couples at Castel Gandolfo, and he talked about what a crime it was that you had the cross of Christ overshadowed by the crooked cross, the swastika, and that this was a disgrace to the Italian nation as a Christian nation.
You were listening there to Professor Gerald Fogarty, who's currently teaching at the University of Virginia in the United States. Finally, in a related but more quirky note, I'd like to step back in time to the days of a Renaissance cardinal who once had a vineyard planted where the Quirinal Palace now stands, understandably so as it's located on the highest of Rome's seven hills, a site so stunning that even the Emperor Napoleon elected it as his residence in 1809. Forcing the Pope of the time, Pius VII, into a French exile. The cardinal in question is Oliviero Carafa, who once had his country seat on the Quirinal Hill, as historian Stella Fletcher is about to tell you in her series Tales of Scarlet.
Oliviero Carafa, a Neapolitan cardinal. The Carafa were one of the most powerful families in the Kingdom of Naples. We're looking at the palace that stands on the site of the palace where Carafa lived. The palace that's here now is very, very regular, very grand, but it does actually occupy an odd-shaped site. And indeed, Carafa's palace occupied that very same odd-shaped site. But his palace was all higgledy-piggledy in the way of the 15th century palaces. They sort of grew as the cardinal's household's needs expanded. So that if the cardinal became more important and more people joined his household, then he'd say, OK, we need more room. So he might buy a shop or two and then build on that site. Oliviero Carafa was one of the most highly respected cardinals of his day. Now, those people who are interested in the scandals associated with Renaissance cardinals consistently overlook Carafa because he is scandal-free. was a cardinal for many decades. He was made a cardinal by Paul II in 1467, but didn't die until 1511. And indeed, on a number of occasions, people thought that he might get the papacy. In fact, had a man like Caraffa been made pope, then the reputation of Renaissance popes might be rather different than it actually is today. Let's think about the highlights of his career just for a second. In 1472, Pope Sixtus IV sent him as a legate. He was legate to the fleet that was sent against the Turks. He brought back a few Turkish prisoners and had them baptised near his villa on the Quirinal. Many of the Renaissance cardinals divided their time between their palaces in the city centre and their villas on the outskirts. We're talking about a period before Cardinal d'Este's villa at Tivoli, so that they are smaller structures and they are closer to the city. Anyway, Caraffa collected sculptures. But many of Caraffa's sculptures were kept at that villa on the Quirinal. However, one sculpture he brought here, and he had placed next to his palace here in the very heart of the Centro Storico. The sculpture is known as Pasquino. And it was Cardinal Caraffa who started the feast of Pasquino. Let me tell you a little about the sort of things that happened. The poets of the early 16th century would express their feelings about what was going on in the world around them, pretty much like satirists today. And they would attach their poems to this statue. I keep mentioning Erasmus, and I'm reminded here of Erasmus's Praise of Folly. Erasmus criticizes the society of his day, but he says, "Oh, it's not me speaking, it's folly. Folly speaks." And this is exactly what is going on here. Lots of people are criticizing the government of the popes and the lives and lifestyles of the cardinals. And they do so anonymously by attaching these messages, these poems, to the statue of Pasquino. Now, as Oliviero Caraffa, a cardinal himself, started the annual feast of Pasquino, possibly he recognised, as Pope Paul II had not, the importance of having writers on his side.
That was historian Stella Fletcher telling the tale of that very first cardinal to build villa and vineyard on the Quirinal Hill. And that brings me up to time. I do hope you enjoyed this broadcast. I'm Veronica Scaresbrick. Thanks so much for listening. Don't forget that we'll be back again at this same time tomorrow, so be sure to join us then. Meanwhile, should you wish to check out our website, the address is www.rv.va, and then click on the English World icon. You've been listening to the English programme of Vatican Radio. Laudetur Jesus Christus.